I forgot who it was exactly, but someone came up to me and said, Eric, I heard that you only got through three questions this last hour. Was it just three? I was thinking maybe it was four. I don't know. But anyway, this is kind of where we ended up with. And let's talk about this one. Doesn't evolution actually occur at least on small levels? We'll cover that one here in just a minute. Let's get on to one or two others, and then we'll go back to that one. How do you refute radiocarbon dating? This goes hand in hand with what we finished last hour. How do you refute radiocarbon dating? It is proposed so much as fact in academic circles, and given my understanding of half-lives and how it works, I do not know how to rationalize that with a young Earth view. So, very good question. And maybe whoever asked the question might know a whole lot more about radiocarbon dating and radiometric dating than a lot of us. Hey, that's a great question. Gotcha. There it is. Right. And so people in the class think, well, yeah, I mean, the Earth's got to be universe has to be the soul. By the way, let me just say, it's a whole lot less intimidating answering questions like this than trying to teach a song to 200 people. I cannot imagine how hard that must be. If someone asked me to do something like that, oh, I would be so nervous and so bad at it, pretty much. So thank you for last song you taught us, such a beautiful song. And don't you love how many beautiful songs there are that come straight from Scripture like that? May have been that the first century Christians were singing Psalm 34 and their tune was quite a bit different than the tune that we sing it with today. But wow, what a beautiful song. Thank you for that. Okay, so here is how I would respond to this. First of all, in somewhat of a general way, every dating method is based on certain assumptions, certain unproven and unprovable assumptions. And so if you're in a chemistry class, like my youngest son, middle child, is in at Freed right now, that if I might just say I've heard is kicking his tail, that's probably not the most eloquent way of saying it, but I mean, this has been one doozy of a semester that he's had. And but I think he's improved. I think he went from like a D student to a C to a B. But anyway, Jeremiah was driving through Henderson a few weeks ago, and I realized I saw my oldest son and my daughter. I had taken her up there for some kind of weekend, and I saw her, and I was dropping her off, and she was going to be riding back with someone else. But I hadn't seen my other son, and I called him. I said, "Hey, can I see you before I leave town?" And he was like, "I'm in a study session, Dad." So I said, "Well, where are you at?" He said, "I'm in the library." And so it just so happened that he was in a study session with three pretty girls. So I just wondered if that's what's going on with his grades. He was in a chemistry. He was working on that chemistry, I suppose. Something like that. So anyway, that's no joke. That's just what I was witnessing. And I was afraid that Dad was raining on his party. But you know, Jeremiah, we just have to tease our kids a little bit, embarrass them a little bit. I figure it's good for them. Hey, listen, my dad used to drop me off in front of the middle school, junior high that I used to go to, in front of the junior high, in a Vega that was bright yellow and about 20 years old, and it had butterflies on the side of it. So you want to talk about a good embarrassing experience that happened day after day. I mean, I was like, we would pick up my friends sometimes to go to school, and I was like, "Hey, buddy, Andy, you can ride in the front, and I'll ride in the back." I don't know if he knew that was a plan I had, that I just really didn't want to get out of the car first. But anyway, I'm getting way, way off track. Okay, so I would say number one, it's just a fact that all of these dating methods, they're based on assumptions. And here's what I mean. So let's say that you're in class and they say, "Well, here, this rock has uranium in it, and maybe it's specifically uranium-238. And it also has lead in it." And the chemistry teacher may say, "Well, what we know from tests is that uranium naturally breaks down into lead." Okay, that's what happens over time. And according to their figures, they contend that uranium, the half-life of uranium is, let's say, so many billions, let's just say it's 4 billion years, or 4.5 billion years. That may be what they say it actually is. And so they say, if there are 25 ounces of uranium-238 and 25 ounces of lead, then this must be 4.5 billion years old, because 4.5 billion years earlier, there would have been 50 ounces of uranium-238 and no ounces of lead. And so that may be kind of a simplistic way to explain it. And so they say, well, here's what we have today. And so we know based upon the decay rate today, what it is decaying at and the rate it's decaying at. And so we just figure that backwards, and we can figure out how long ago it was when it was totally uranium-238 without any lead in it. And of course, there are all sorts of other elements that they do this with, naturally breaking down over time. Well, remember those assumptions. If you asked anyone who is telling you the certainty of an age of a rock or this part of the earth, whatever, being so many billions of years old, you know, one question to ask is, well, how do you know that the decay rate of this element today is the same decay rate of that element thousands of years ago, or in their case, millions or billions of years ago? How do you know the decay rate was the same? You don't know. It's an assumption. Another question to ask is, how do you know there wasn't any lead in the rock to begin with? I mean, if God created the world, could He not make rocks with both uranium-238 and lead already in it? And so those are just two of the assumptions, and there are more, that people cannot prove that, well, this is what we know this is, and the fact is it's based. So when they say, well, let's calculate this and let's plug this in, those calculations are based on various assumptions that, if they're honest, they will admit, yeah, these are assumptions, but they're assumptions based upon what we know, we think today. It might be kind of like, let's say that you go, anybody here have a swimming pool? Let's say you go, what is your name? Dwayne. Let's say you go to Dwayne's house and you see him filling up, putting water in his pool. And he said, they asked, well, how much longer do you have to fill up this pool? And he says, well, in about an hour, it'll be up to, the 30,000 gallon level. And so then you start calculating backwards. Well, I guess that means if it's going to take an hour and you've already got 29,000 gallons in it, it's going to take you one hour to do 1,000 gallons. And then you just figure backwards, it's taken 30 hours to fill up that pool. And you might assume it's taken him that long, but the fact is, let's say that it had rained like crazy the last week and the pool already had 28,000 gallons of water in it. So really, he only had been filling up the pool for an hour and only has about an hour left to go. So it would be an assumption to say we know that he began filling that pool up from 0 gallons of water. Does that make sense? Does that help you at all? The other thing I'll quickly say, and then I'll see if you have any other questions or comments, is there are other kinds of dating methods like radiocarbon dating that doesn't do evolution any good, radiocarbon 14 dating. I remember this. As a kid, I used to watch the Super Friends. You remember Superman, Batman, Robin, and all sorts of other superheroes, Aquaman and the Green Lantern. And oh, it's been fun raising boys in this day and time where there's so many superhero movies and cartoons and stuff. I mean, my boys came home for Thanksgiving and we watched, what's this new show on Disney, Mandalorian? Anyway, that's not really a superhero thing. I get it. Star Wars, anyway. I remember when my kids were little watching the Superman cartoon with them, and Superman has gone back in time, and he's trapped back in time, and so he leaves something for people to find in the future, and Batman comes along, as I recall, and he radiocarbon dates it backwards to find out that Superman, and this is what they're saying on the cartoon, Superman is back in time, 2.3 million years, we've got to go get him. So this is what, kids are learning. And what actually the science, even evolutionary scientists say radiocarbon dating, that the half-lives of carbon are so short that radiocarbon dating doesn't do any good for anything more than, they would say, more than a few tens of thousands of years old at best, evolutionists say. So there's a lot of confusion about some of the dating methods, and there's a lot of talk of assurance about them when they're based on assumptions, and talk about radiocarbon dating when even evolutionists would say, well, actually, if we go back in time too far, these things that we contend would have carbon in them, the carbon would already be totally gone in 60, 70, 75,000 years, even according to evolutionists. I don't believe the earth is that old, because again, there are assumptions that are tied into even that particular dating method, like the rate of decay of carbon. Listen, if God miraculously, supernaturally created the universe, and on day three, He made the land to appear, and there was geological activity going on. Oh, you know, there was a third assumption, by the way, I didn't get to a while ago, that how do you know that the elements in these rocks have not been affected by outside sources? Like maybe during a catastrophic, cataclysmic, universal, worldwide flood. I don't know if I'll have time to get to this, but one of the questions someone asked is, and I hope I will, is, you know, tell us something about the dinosaur bones they're finding around the world that have soft tissue in them. And hopefully I'll get to it, but I called and talked to Dr. Mary Schweitzer about this probably over a decade ago. She was one of the scientists at North Carolina State University who was spearheading this study based upon a T-Rex femur fossil that was large, big, weighed a ton, so much that she said they had to purposefully break the T-Rex femur. It was so heavy because it was, they thought, all fossilized. And they broke it in half and put it on a helicopter, as I recall correctly, and then came back and got the rest of it. They took it back to their lab. And they began to look at it very, very critically, scientifically examining it. They began to put this solution on it that allowed them to notice, wait a minute, this Tyrannosaurus rex fossil is not completely fossilized. Still had soft, flexible, fibrous tissue in it. So I asked her, my reason for calling her, and she was very kind and considerate for even taking my phone call. I said, have you tried radiocarbon dating it to see if there's any dinosaur, you know, carbon still in it? And her answer was, oh, we wouldn't waste our time doing that because all the carbon would be out of the dinosaur fossil because it's so old. I said, well, maybe it's not as old as you think it is. Well, if there was, and this was her response, if there was any carbon still in the fossil, it would have been contaminated, it would have been from outside sources. I just found that interesting because she is somewhat proving our point about problems with radiometric dating. One of the other assumptions is, how do you know that these elements in the rock, that they've always been there, how do you know that there hasn't been some tampering done, not like illegal tampering or anything, but just from outside chemicals, elements, water, rain, the elements in general, that have caused some problems. So there's a lot of assumptions that are ingrained in all of these dating methods. See, the thing is, no one was around at the beginning. No human being was around at the beginning of time, the beginning of the universe. Who is the only one who could tell us exactly how old the universe is if He chose to? Only God. I mean, God was there. According to Job 38, at least at some point in creation, and maybe right there at the very beginning, if He had already created angels, the morning stars sang, they shouted at the creation that God created. And so, you know, they were there at least for much of it, maybe all of it, of the physical creation. But as far as communicating to man, as far as man figuring out how old the universe is, it's not going to happen. unless we just listen to what God has to say. Any comments or questions on that before we move on? All right. How does the young Earth viewpoint account for ice layers that suggest millions of years of time passing? This was another one that was asked, and I put it after that particular question we just dealt with, just to kind of quickly say, once again, the idea of these ice layers and ice cores that are taken out of, like, Greenland, for example, it is assumed that only one layer of ice is laid down per winter or per year. And so if you have so many, many layers, then the Earth's got to be older than, you know, thousands of years old, like 6,000 or 8,000 or 10,000 years old. It's got to be what? It's got millions of years old based upon this or that? Well, again, the assumption is that there could not have been more than one layer of ice or snow that was compacted in, you know, 1 year. And if you think about the fact that there was an ice age and were probably more like some many ice ages, the creationists believe that it's logical to believe that those would have occurred after the flood. We've got some good discovery articles on that for kids. I think that Dr. Jeff Miller has written on that at Apologetics Press, even in Reason and Revelation, if I remember correctly. If not, it will be coming out before too long. But let me just back up and say this. There, you may have heard about one or more World War II planes that have been discovered on Greenland. And even though it appears, from what I understand, that about 1 foot of ice is laid down about every year, at least in certain parts of Greenland, so it looks like about 1 foot a year. And yet, above some of those at least one of the World War II planes that they have found there, it's got 10 times as many layers as you would expect if it went down in the 1940s. Because there are greater accumulations and layers of ice and snow than what some people might think must have been laid down during 1 year of time. Let's see if I had another question along those lines. Well, here was the one about the dinosaur soft tissue. Can you please update us on some of the new findings like soft tissue and bones and what that means for creationists? And because this question was emailed me, I went ahead and took some of the slides that I have on this because I think it would be more helpful for you to see it. This is a picture of Dr. Mary Schweitzer, and she wrote in, that is not the right reference. I'm not sure. Okay, here it is. She wrote in Science magazine in just a few years ago. I don't know what's wrong with that reference there. But she said with her colleagues, soft tissues are preserved within hind limb elements of Tyrannosaurus rex. Removal of the mineral phase reveals transparent, flexible, hollow blood vessels. Some regions of demineralized bone matrix are highly fibrous, and the matrix possesses elasticity and resilience. And ladies and gentlemen, she's talking about a dinosaur bone that was assumed, would have been assumed to have been completely fossilized, but they broke it. They intentionally broke this, and then they discovered, wait a minute, this thing is not fossilized. The bone had not completely turned into rock. That's what fossilization is. It just looks like it's in the shape of the animal's bone, right? But it's rock. Well, this one wasn't completely, you know, fossilized or made into rock. And these were her words. Here's an evolutionist, her words describing it. She said the demineralized fragment is flexible and resilient, and when stretched, get that, some of the tissue could be stretched, returns to its original shape. And then I believe this was a year or two later in the same magazine, Science magazine, she again with her colleagues wrote, demineralization of femur and tibia fragments revealed the preservation of fibrous, flexible, and apparently original tissues as well as apparent cells and blood vessels. And here were the pictures from Science magazine. And these are pictures. That almost looks like some chicken, doesn't it? I mean, can you believe this? We've been told for decades now dinosaurs, they lived millions, tens of millions of years before humans allegedly evolved. That dinosaurs went extinct some 65 million years ago. And they're finding dinosaur bones that are not completely fossilized and taking even microscopes and looking at certain look at the stretch in this tissue here. And they're not just finding this in just one or two places. But they will still contend that 70 million year old Tyrannosaurus rex fossil dug out of a hunk of sandstone has yielded soft tissue, including blood vessels. But they make sure they get that in there. Now, this is 70 million years old, but hey, it's soft tissue and blood vessels. Paleontologists were stunned to find that soft tissue of a 70 million year old dinosaur was preserved within a fossil from a Tyrannosaurus rex. Alan Boyle, who was the former science editor at MSNBC, the not-so-conservative MSNBC, he said, today paleontologists are still stunned not only to find material that looks like dinosaur cartilage, blood vessels, blood cells, and bone cells, but to see the stuff, he said, in so many different specimens. He said, there are a growing number of tissue samples. It's not just a fluke occurrence. It's something that's more pervasive in the fossil record. He said, they have excavated a T-Rex and Hadrosaur from Montana, Titanosaurus from Madagascar, and more samples that fossil hunter Jack Horner, he's probably one of the world's most well-known dinosaur fossil hunters, that Jack Horner is finding in Mongolia as well as Montana. Regarding the Hadrosaur specimen found in Montana, Dr. Mary Schweitzer said, it's the freshest, think about using that word, the freshest, if you will, dinosaur bone that has ever had this analysis conducted on it. What we're finding is absolutely incredible, amazing preservation. In fact, there was an article in the Baltimore Sun that said this was miraculously preserved soft tissue from the femur of a 68 million year old T-Rex. To which I would respond, yeah, it would be miraculous if it was actually 70 million or 65 to 70 million years old. Just out of curiosity, how many of you, if you don't mind me asking, how many of you knew about this? Some of you? Okay, maybe about 10% or so of you. It seems like this would be, nightly news kind of stuff. Like, hey, we've been telling kids for years that dinosaurs separated from human beings by 70 million years or 65 million. And yet now we're finding soft dinosaur tissue in not just one or two places, but in various places around the world. Now that some of the paleontologists are intentionally breaking apart the fossils to see, are these bones actually fully fossilized? Here is kind of a blown up picture of an electron micrograph of a portion of tissue that's being stretched, tissue from a Thessalosaurus vertebra. And this is used and came from the Creation Research Society. Here is a, you see, it's not just the evolutionists who are studying this and finding this. There are creationists now who are able to and getting into this and finding out for themselves as well. Wait a minute. We've got soft tissue that has yet to be explained logically from anyone who thinks that this could just be sitting around for many, many millions of years. A few years ago, kind of on the same subject matter, there was a gentleman, Mr. Hugh Miller, who sent two dinosaur fossil specimens to the Department of Geosciences at the University of Arizona, did not tell them what they were, and asked them if they would radiocarbon date it, the C analysis here, and they sent him back dates of this bone being somewhere around 10,000 to 16,000 years old using their radiocarbon dating method. Now, I'm not contending that these dates are exactly right, but you know, they didn't know they were testing dinosaur bone. It was a blind test. My understanding is once they found out that it was, that they would just argue, well, whatever carbon was in this dinosaur bone had been, affected by had come into the dinosaur bone from an outside source and wasn't actually, did not originate in the dinosaur bone. So they would say it's actually not that old. But any questions or comments on that before we move on? Yes, sir. That's exactly right. Someone might say, "Well, why does the Earth look old? Why does the Earth look so old?" We might first ask, "Well, what does a young Earth look like?" I mean, old, young. But number two, the thing is, God made, as the brother just pointed out, a mature universe. When God made the chicken, He didn't have to, wait for an egg to hatch. When God made the fruit trees in the garden, he didn't have to plant the seed and wait a number of years for it to begin bearing fruit. When He created stars on day four in the heavens, Adam did not have to wait for decades or centuries. What did Adam live? 930 years, I believe. He didn't have to wait till his 929th birthday to see if any light had reached Earth from the stars yet. He created the stars mature so that He miraculously made it, so that the light from those stars that are far, far away, that light was here miraculously, virtually, immediately. It is a mature creation. All right, let's see if we can get to another question here. All right, here was another one that was asked. In all your years of research and study, what are the most prominent, compelling things that have solidified and substantiated your faith in God, your faith in God and His existence? I'm looking for the things that you have discovered that completely made you say, yep, He's real and He's awesome. It's impossible to not have faith in Him after seeing, realizing, and knowing this. That's a great question. It's almost like saying, if you love to eat food, and it's like, what's your favorite food? Man, I don't know. I like about everything. I mean, that barbecue we had today was amazing. That was good stuff. The chicken was. The pork was. That was pork, right? Pulled pork. Wow. I mean, it was mighty good. I like pizza. I like chocolate pie. And anyway, that's kind of how I feel in answering this question. So I would contend that some of the first things that come to my mind are really the things that I already talked to the young people about today. That oftentimes it's some of the stuff that's staring us in our faces that when you grow up from a child, you take so many things for granted. And then you stop one day and you ask yourself, I exist. This whole realm exists. Where did it all come from? You see, there are only three explanations, only three logical possible explanations. And I say logical explanations. There's only three logical possibilities, I suppose, theoretically speaking. That is, that everything came from nothing. Everything, the universe has always existed, number two, or it came from a supernatural creator. Those are your three possibilities. Either we came from nothing, we've always been here, the universe, or something outside of the material realm created the material realm. And once I realize you got three options, and you see the unscientific, illogical first two explanations, that only leaves you with one logical possibility, and it's hard for some to accept because God is eternal, and we're all finite creatures with a beginning. And so it's hard for us to just, it's almost gives you a headache to think about, you mean there is an uncreated, eternal, spiritual being? Yes, and that's the only logical explanation for the presence of a physical realm. So that would be, the law of causality, the cosmological argument. That is probably the most foundational, fundamental argument for the existence of God. And it's that way because I think it's the best, if you will. It's the most fundamental. Yes? if you're using faith in the sense that people use faith, yes. Yeah, then, you know, does it take more faith to be an atheist than to believe in God? Yes, in the sense that if you're defining faith as just believing in something that there's no real evidence for. And I say that because the biblical definition of faith, that's not the biblical definition. But that is the worldly definition. That's the definition when you look at it in Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Faith is something that you believe in for which there is no evidence. Well, that's atheistic evolutionary science. I guess I would say for me, maybe, besides the design argument that I referred to as argument number three when I was talking earlier to the young people and you all, but when I began to wrap my mind around these historical arguments, they've been around. There's nothing new here. It's not like I made this up or anyone at AP made this up. These are great arguments that have been around for centuries, and thus that's why millions of people have logically come to the conclusion, billions, that there is a God. But when you begin to think critically about the fact that if God does not exist, and this to me is just a very powerful, powerful thought. If God does not exist, nothing can ever be said to be objectively right or wrong or good or evil or fair or unfair or just or unjust. Nothing can be. There would only, if there is no God and all of us are just higher animals, if we evolved from worms and fish and amphibians and reptiles and mammals, and here we are today, and we're all just from animals, none of us could say that we know that it is wrong to beat and to kill and mutilate a six-month-old child. Or that it is wrong. You know, when my colleague Kyle Butt debated Dan Barker at the University of South Carolina 10 years ago, he challenged Mr. Barker, probably the most well-known atheist in the U.S. He is the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation up in Madison, Wisconsin. They're the ones that go all around the country suing school boards and, you know, different local municipal groups and so forth in cities because they dare to have the Ten Commandments on the wall, or they even went after a police officer in Wetumpka, Alabama because she dared to have Bible studies with some of the kids in the community on her days off. I mean, just crazy. But in this debate, Kyle said, Mr. Barker, you've been on record saying that nothing. You see, if atheism is taken to its logical conclusion, Dan Barker took it this way when he said, nothing could ever be said to be absolutely right or absolutely wrong. And so Kyle asked him, he said, well, Mr. Barker, when would rape ever be right? And Mr. Barker, he tried to step back, walk it back a little bit. He said, well, you know, I'd never do that, and I think that's horrible and disgusting or whatever else. But, you know, if you were just to ask me, you know, if aliens came to this earth, and of course atheists, most atheists believe in aliens, that why would we be the only living things in the universe, right, if you're an atheist? And he said, if aliens ever came to this planet and they said, they looked at me or someone, they said, listen, you have to violate this woman or we're going to destroy your world. Then he would say, I would feel compelled. I would have to hurt that person, violate them, whatever. And then if I recall correctly in the debate, Kyle said, well, you know, if you were told to do it more than once, or if you were to hurt not just one woman, but two women. And his answer was, well, if the greater, you know, good outweighed the bad, then we would have to just... But see, if there is no God, who's to say what's good and bad? And so I say all that to say the whole discussion of even commenting on if anything is good or evil or right or wrong or just or unjust cannot even be discussed if there is no higher being who is outside of the physical realm, who is the originator and standard, unless it flows from his very essence. This, by the way, from what I understand, is what drove C.S. Lewis to believe more than ever that God exists, because you can't even have a discussion about good or evil without a higher being. Any comments or questions on that before we move on? Right. Well, you know, in World War II, and Thomas B. Warren points this out, if I recall correctly, to Anthony Flew in that debate many years ago. Anthony Flew, if I recall correctly, served in World War II, and so he was very familiar with this. He said, upon what basis did Adolf Hitler and the Nazis say that they were doing right? Well, upon German law. So, if German law says it was okay for them to exterminate, kill millions. See, I recall correctly, wasn't it like 3 million or 6 million Jews? 6 million Jews? Not to mention some of the Poles and Soviets and some others. They were saying they did right because they were just following. I mean, if you were recruited to be a part of the Nazi army, and you were told by your higher-ups, this is what's right, this is what we're doing, how could anyone say they were wrong? Well, they were judged, history shows us, by what was called a higher power. They weren't judged by U.S. law, right? Germans have their own law. We have our own law, right? But they were judged, and the only way that they could be judged rightly is if there is a higher law. And if there is a God. So here's my point, and I'll move on to the next slide. And that is, if good and evil, if there is such a thing as fairness and unfairness, and everybody knows there is. I mean, it's like we were saying earlier, does anyone say, I don't want to be loved? I mean, you know, and just say, I hate it when people love me kind of thing. Who in the world could see a line that people have been waiting in for days for bread? Who in the world doesn't know it's unfair for someone just to cut into the front of that line and bypass everyone else just by their brute strength and whatever else? Everybody just has this innate understanding of what is some things that are fair and unfair. Well, if good and evil exist, then God exists. And if the atheists have to logically, they have to admit that, though some people still refuse to. But then if they say, well, there is no, like Dan Barker says, there is no good and evil. And I would just contend that for those who claim there is no such thing as good and evil, that they are merely showing the sickness and the repulsiveness of atheistic thought. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God, right? Before I get to Jeremiah, let me just read. The fool said in his heart, there is no God. You know what's stated right after that? They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good. Verse 3, they have together become corrupt. There is none who does good. No, not one. If there is no God. If there is no, can you imagine living in a world really where everybody carried that to its logical conclusion? Jeremiah? I was going to say that one of the things that they really try to have success with arguing that there is not enough God like that to happen. They're actually arguing against themselves that they're saying this is wrong. This can happen to people. And then there's no right. That's right. And that's what. That's what I read years ago from C.S. Lewis commenting on, saying, wait a minute, if you're saying this, you're assuming there is some such thing as... Yeah, that's right. Looks like we have our young people coming in. Is that right, Chase? How much longer can I go? Well, I tell you what, okay, well, this was another question that I got, and I haven't gotten to all of them, but I think I've gotten to almost all of them. I need info to go along with the information I have to teach about plate tectonics and continental drift. And so very quickly, let me just say, a lot of people wonder about, you know, the idea of Pangea, that were all the continents. You know, when you look at the continents, I kind of liked puzzles as a kid. It looks like if you kind of shove them all together that they would kind of fit nicely together. And that's a simplistic way of looking at it and saying it. And so some people wonder, well, wait a minute, the science textbooks talk about how there was once this big supercontinent, and then over billions of years or millions of years, they separated. And so people want to know about this idea of plate movement and tectonics and the continental drift. And so how does this fit into the Bible and the creation model? And the answer is, number one, I suppose we're not just 100% sure. Like, you know, the Bible doesn't talk a whole lot about it. Some people wonder about that passage in Genesis 10 that says, in the days of Peleg, the earth was divided. But that is referring to, I believe, in context, the division of people, not the actual earth, the division of people, Genesis chapter 11, verse 1, by their languages. However, creationists, Christians, have no problem with the idea of plate tectonics and the continental drift, just that it didn't happen over millions or billions of years, that it could have happened very rapidly, such as, think about how rapid the geologic activity was at creation. You make the land to appear up out of the water, and you have mountains being formed, and then hundreds of years later, during the flood, could there have been a lot of geologic activity? Again, the Bible doesn't tell us a whole lot. Let me tell you two verses, and then if you have a question, we'll take it, and then our time will be up. But you know, in Genesis chapter 7 and verse, let's see what it is here. Verse 11 says, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up. All the fountains of the great deep were broken up. You know, that is probably an allusion to some big time geologic activity. Let me read one other passage. I have this written out in the margin of my Bible. I'm reading from, well, let me ask you this. Does anybody have the ESV in here? ESV, can you read, because I really think I can read you, I'll read you the New King James and you read me the ESV. Psalm 104. Listen to this. I believe this is talking, you know, about the flood. I'm going to read it from the King James. I'll read you the footnote that I have in mind. And then, what is your name, brother? Jonathan, you can read us from the ESV. Look at verses 6 through 8. You covered it with the deep, the garment, the water stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. The waters fled, you see. At the voice of your thunder, they hastened away. They went up over the mountains. They went down to the valleys, to the place which you founded them. My footnote, you may have one too, says, or the mountains rose up, the valleys sank down. Read the ESV for us. In my judgment, even though it's possible that some of this could be applying to creation, at the creation, in my judgment, this is specifically about the flood and ties in very well with the idea of the breaking up of the plates and the great fountains of the deep being broken up during the flood. If you've got that kind of geologic activity happening all over during the flood, there's no telling how fast some of these things were happening. And so creationists have no problem with the idea of a possible supercontinent early on that was broken up later. And I tell you what, I work with a guy named Jeff Miller. He's a graduate of Freed. Also, I don't know if you're an Auburn fan. Maybe you are since they beat Alabama the other day, but he has his PhD from Auburn. And he has written more in the Lord's Church on this subject we're talking about than anyone that I know. And he's probably going to be putting out a book for kids before too long on the flood. We'll deal with some of this. He's written some in Discovery, and I think he's got some good stuff on our website on it. If it's not there, it will be shortly. But it would be it's real fascinating to me. Any quick comments or questions before we end? Is that in the back here? Do you have one? Okay. Thank you all very much.